in the center, and that allows Judge Klopacki to have a visual. He's in St. Cloud today. The roads are too treacherous to travel, and so he is able to participate visually and see you through that device, as well as he is able to participate and obviously hear the argument, but to ask questions. So if you hear his voice, it'll sound like it's coming out of nowhere, but he really is here and present, and you should include him, as of course you will, Judge Jessen and I. So having said all of that, I'll have the marshal call the second case, and then I'll have just a couple of quick other remarks, and we'll go ahead with the argument.
Now calling case number A22-1425, State of Minnesota Appellant versus Tyann Onwo-Whitley, respondent.
All right, and counsel, I see both of you are now seated and look like you're ready to proceed. I want to remind you of just a couple of things. We do record the arguments today, and that is later made available on our website. That's an audio recording. And so for that reason, I ask you to make sure that you, before you start your remarks at the podium, and please use the center podium. That's best for our sound as well as our recording, and it'll let you see the time. Before you start your remarks, identify yourself as well as the client that you represent, and then just keep an eye on the clock. It tends to go quickly. We do look forward to the conversation. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the appellant in this matter, the state of Minnesota. This case is about whether a short driveway that is far from the house relative to the property and outside the fence that surrounds and shields the backyard, and that a public sidewalk cuts across and that is right up against the street, whether that all is curtilage under the Fourth Amendment. And it is not. Three issues have been briefed in this case, and I'm happy to answer questions and discuss all three, but I think the most important issue, and the one that makes it unnecessary to reach the third issue, is whether the location of the Dodge Charger on the driveway was the curtilage of the house. And that curtilage determination turns on the specific facts in this particular case.
The driveway where this car was located, was it on city right-of-way part of a driveway or on the owner's property part of the driveway?
So in page 15 of the addendum to my principal brief, there's that photograph that shows the public sidewalk kind of cutting across that short driveway. Judge Klopacki, if I understand your question correctly, the Dodge Charger was parked between that sidewalk and the garage, so on private property, and it would have, my understanding is that it would have taken up essentially that entire space, because again, this is not a long driveway.
And how close was this to the structure itself?
By structure, do you mean the garage?
Yes.
The record does not indicate how close it was to that. It says it was on the driveway. We have the photograph.
The driveway we're talking about is the one going into the garage?
Correct. That's the only driveway on the property.
If I could follow up on Judge Klopacki's question, is it in the record how close the driveway is to the home itself?
I don't believe there's any numerical measurements in the record.
So, Mr. Petras, when you started out, you talked about how far from the driveway was from the house relative to the property. And my question is, why do we look at that relative to the property? I mean, when I've looked at some of the case law, we look at Dunn, they talk about, well, the barn was 60 yards from the house, or... Shoot, am I pronouncing that correctly?
You are.
Okay. The dirt driveway was in close proximity to the suburban home. You know, it just looking at, so I understand there's not, we don't have this measured in yards here in the record, but looking at the pictures, it looks like a relatively modest home on a small lot. So wouldn't you say, you know, so why do we look at the distance relative to the property? Why don't we say really that anything in that small lot is really pretty close when we're looking at proximity, that first Dunn factor?
Well, a lot of the United States Supreme Court decisions addressing curtilage, the older ones like Dunn and Oliver, they discuss more rural properties. And a lot of the circuit court decisions do too. There are some circuit court decisions like Bean, which I cite on page 7 of my reply brief, and Shute, for that matter, which was my case. I'm pretty familiar with the record on that if you want to dig into the details. There were not numerical measurements in Shute either. There was just photographs.
But it was a suburban, you know, said it's suburban property, which I would assume from just reading that decision in the record here would be larger than this property here.
Being familiar with both properties, I would agree with that assessment. And the point I was making, and this is just one aspect of one of the four Dunn factors, is that on this particular property, on 1731 Newton Avenue North, you cannot get further from the house itself while still remaining on that private property than being on the driveway.
And I'm just going back to my original question, what case tells us that's the way we should be looking at it when measuring proximity?
I'm not sure if there's a specific case that maybe makes that as a principle of law. I guess my understanding is that all private property is comprised, you have your house, which is what the Fourth Amendment actually attaches to and emanates from. It doesn't attach to and emanate to from the garage. It doesn't attach to and emanate to from some space next to the house. It comes from the house itself. And then you have the curtilage. And there's
how far was this car from the house?
Again, the record is silent when it comes to numerical measurements, Judge Klopaki. It was outside of the fenced-in backyard. And the entire backyard of this house is fenced in, a solid fence that you cannot see through that stretches from the rear of the house all the way to the side of the garage and excludes, the only part that is excluded from that fenced in more private portion is the driveway where the Dodge Charger was.
So, Counselor,
well,
that's what I was just going to ask you. I mean, there's no
there are gated communities, not in North Minneapolis, but there are gated communities in which you can have like a driveway shielded.
So going back to Judge Justin's point, I mean, isn't part of this to consider the community that we're in? This is an urban community. From my vantage point as a resident of South Minneapolis, it looks very much like my neighborhood, and
likewise, the
garages and driveways in my neighborhood. So, you know, this is a small lot. And isn't that the relevant point to proximity? Not so much the fact that in this record we don't have the physical distances.
Proximity is just one of the four Dunn factors, and I am not aware of any case that holds that an urban lot by definition, or that a smaller lot by definition, the entire lot is curtilage. I'm not aware of it says that anywhere in case law. I think all lots are comprised of both curtilage.
I mean, it is a case-by-case determination, right?
Exactly. Curtilage? I'm not aware of a case that holds that with respect to an urban lot. Bean was an urban lot. Shute was a suburban lot. There's some other circuit court decisions I cite in my my reply brief that deal with more kind of suburban urban lots. Wells was I believe that was a more urban lot, and they made a distinction in Wells, which was cited both in response brief and in my reply brief. That's an Eighth Circuit decision. Again, of course, not binding on this court, but where the driveway that was visible from the street was not curtilage, whereas where the officers went and actually recovered the incriminating evidence in that case in the backyard was not visible from the street, and they walked along the driveway into the backyard. Yes, Judge Klopaki?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't ask the question.
Oh, I apologize. I can't stress enough the importance of the fence and the detached garage. And what I mean by detached garage, and this is driving to your point.
Help me here for a minute. If you ran that fence connected to two sections that are on both sides of the driveway, if you made that connection, would this car have been within the fence line?
It would have been closer to. I understand the point, Judge Klopaki, both you and Judge Bradfield said before, is you can't completely fence off a driveway. And some of the older cases, like Lewis from 1978. Yes, Judge?
Isn't the question here of how private is all of this? And that's the reason we have this curtilage concept, the kind of privacy that people expect, the area that they use exclusively, as opposed to people up and down the street.
I agree.
The controlling case law clearly states that curtilage is the area of private property that is for the, you know, most intimate activities, that is immediately surrounding the home, that is for the privacies of life. You've seen discussions in the cases talking about, you know, fire pits, or talking about kids' toys, or talking about, you know, a patio, or talking about a front porch. I'm not aware of cases that specifically say, I don't believe any has been cited, that because you can park a car on that portion of the property, it is the most, it falls within that kind of umbrella definition of curtilage. And I should stress, too, that the Dunn factors are, I don't want to say advisory, but there's not a mechanical application here. They are something that has helped guide this court to make a determination about whether the piece of this particular piece of private property, this particular portion of the private property, is curtilage or is non-curtilage, which case law often refers to as open fields. But there are cases, both from our state's Supreme Court as well as from the United States Supreme Court. For instance, Collins, the most recent case addressing a similar fact pattern, perhaps, in which they do not apply the Dunn factors. They just make a decision. And the car...
Well, something we might disagree with you on the curtilage question...
This exception that was raised below is exigency or exigent circumstances. And that was guided again from that Collins decision, in which they held that when a vehicle is on the curtilage of a house, that the automobile exception cannot apply to lifting a tarp to inspect the vehicle. But the court, it was not necessarily holding in Collins, but specifically pointed out that other exceptions, and then it named exigent circumstances, could apply. And if you're going into exigent circumstances, I want to stress that the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment here, it's reasonableness. And what we have going on is the investigators didn't go up to the Dodge Charger and open up the car doors and start rifling through things or try to pop open the trunk and look for any incriminating evidence. It was a very minimal act of moving the tarp to confirm evidence that they had gathered from other sources about the license plate of the car. Judge Justin?
But how hard would it be in those circumstances? You see the car there, you get the warrant. I mean, like, isn't that really? I mean, you're talking about reasonableness, but don't we also look at that? And that just doesn't seem to me that hard to do here.
I was not there at the scene. I do not know the law enforcement resources at the moment. I understand your point, Judge Justin. I feel that literally every Fourth Amendment case that comes before the court, this is starting in the 1950s and 60s, is why didn't they just get a warrant? But these exceptions do exist for reasons, and I think
the requirement for a warrant exists for a reason.
I totally agree, Judge Justin. I think the issue here is that you're not dealing with something that obviously the car was mobile. It had driven from the scene. It was not clear, and this may have been confused in the briefing. It was not clear to the investigators when they saw it on the morning of December 7th if the car had been there since the time of the crash or had been moving around and was just as likely to leave in a matter of minutes as it was to stay there. They did not know who was in the house. They did not know who had access to keys to the vehicle. So I understand that getting a warrant would have taken some time. The record is silent as to how long that would have taken. But a car obviously could have been driven away from that scene in less time than it would have taken to get a warrant.
Yeah, help me with one more fact. Is this garage a detached garage?
It is. It is detached. It's completely detached. And that is a point I was touching on before. The garage does not have any Fourth Amendment protection in and of itself. The garage may be on curtilage. It may be part of the curtilage of the home, again, with that Fourth Amendment protection emanating from the house. Just like the fenced-in portion of the backyard, literally the entire backyard with that solid fence could be part of the curtilage, but the garage is detached, so it just being near the garage itself, you can't be like curtilage of the garage simply because the garage itself would be curtilage. And I know Judge Justin, when you wrote the Lindman opinion, you directly addressed that argument that I cited in my principal brief.
But Mr. Petras, that was kind of a piece of property on what, 12 plus acres in rural Minnesota, which seems to be pretty different than what we have here. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that the properties are very different in that respect. I still will stand by my position that even in an urban setting, I live in South Minneapolis as well. I have a fenced-in backyard. I have, I guess you could consider it a driveway, but we call it just basically the cement slab that's outside of our garage, detached garage that flows into the alley. I would not consider that to be the curtilage of my home, again, because it is fully visible to the publicly accessible alley. It is outside the fenced portion of the house. I've done nothing to try to shield it.
Could I ask one question with that regard? Because the district court referred to this as far as the ability to exclude someone from being in the driveway. How does that fit into your analysis?
In this particular case, again, the Dodge Charger would have barely fit on the portion of the driveway between that sidewalk and the garage. The public sidewalk is the public sidewalk. Anyone, including law enforcement, could have been walking up there and presumably doing anything that they wanted to if it was on the sidewalk itself. Drawing a line between what amounts to a matter of maybe like 20 inches between that paved portion of the sidewalk and the paved portion of the driveway would be a very fine line that would not really be that easy, I think, to understand, which is, again, a hallmark of curtilage, is that it's easily understood from our daily experiences. The fenced-in portions of the property, the things that we do to kind of shield property from... Judge Bratvold, I see my time has just expired. May I make my last point? Going to your question, I think, Judge Justin, is that curtilage itself is not necessarily the objects. It is the land. It is the garage can be on the curtilage. The backyard can be curtilage. But putting something, whether it be a vehicle that's covered by a tarp or whether it be a storage container sitting on there, that object itself, which is movable, is not curtilage. Curtilage is not movable. It is real property. And I know I will have time remaining. I'm happy to answer any more questions, but I understand I will be back up here.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Some gravity issues here. My apologies. I'll lay it flat. Okay. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the respondent in this case, my client, Kyan Whitley. In this case, I would like to focus as well on the curtilage issue, if I may, and begin by just stating that in the district court's order, the court relied primarily on the Shute case, and I believe evidently for good reason. Shute addresses most of the questions, if not all of the questions in this case, very spot on. But there is one thing I would like to highlight that I don't think I did necessarily in my brief. In looking at the Shute case, before they proceeded to the Dunn factors, they cited a couple of foundational criteria for assessing what is curtilage, and both of those assessments were taken from the Oliver case, which seems to be the seminal case here. First, that a backyard and a driveway of a home are often considered to be within the curtilage of a home. Secondly, that curtilage includes, quote, the area around the home to which the activity of home life extends. This court, in its questioning during appellant's argument, has already noted the proximity of this garage and driveway to the home. And I would hope to clarify this issue by referring the court to page 16 of appellant's addendum. It is a cross shot of the home showing both the back of the house and the detached garage. The naked eye can readily discern that the distance from my client's house to her detached garage is somewhere in the vicinity of 20 feet, perhaps 25. This is not a large lot. It is a corner lot, but it was never in dispute at the district court by either party that this driveway on which the Charger was parked was within my client's property. So the district court addressed the four Dunn factors. I would like to take issue with appellant suggesting that the Dunn factors are optional. Collins did not engage in the Dunn factor analysis because it was a carport attached to the home. I believe Justice Sotomayor actually said, there are some cases where it's just obvious. So they didn't do the Dunn factor analysis. The reason they didn't do it in the Milton case is because that involved a duplex where the area searched was a common area. Thus, the Dunn factors are inapplicable. From what I've seen, and I've looked at a lot of cases, the Dunn factors are always used whenever there's a question about some area, not directly attached to the home, but within the property, being part of the curtilage. I think as well that appellant has provided an answer to the question that was brought up before about, is there a case that suggests a driveway or another area within someone's property could not be curtilage? Well, appellant cited a number of federal cases in trying to say that a driveway could be excluded. The first one he cited was the Blevins case at 422 F3rd 445. The reason that the area in question there was considered separate was because it was in a separately demarcated area on the property. There was a separate fence around it, away from the central enclosure, which was fenced as well. Now, appellant is striving to try to say that this driveway is somehow cut off from the property, but I think Judge Klapacki was getting at the point there. This driveway is not demarcated from this property. It is bordered by one fence on its west side. The garage is not a barrier or a boundary to the property. If anything, it is a throughway. The fact that it is a structure does not demarcate the driveway from my client's property. So then, again, like Shute, the other boundary, it's bordered on three sides, is a line of trees, just like in Shute. Now, one thing I had noticed, the Shute case cited U.S. v. Riley. I think it was the only other federal district court that they referred to. In Riley, they found that a dilapidated fence and small hedgerows were sufficient to demarcate property. It has never been necessary for property to be obscured from public view for it to be considered curtilage. There is no reference in Shute to the tree line being opaque. It simply says there was a line of trees. The context that must be addressed is those two foundational questions, I think.
So, counsel, if you'd go to the second of those two foundational questions you mentioned and explain how that influences your analysis of curtilage in this case. In other words, what I guess I'm asking you to talk about is how the area around this particular house, so we're talking about the driveway, extends to or protects activity of the home life. And I might have that a little off, but so feel free to revise it.
No, I think you accurately summarized the point taken from Shute. The activities of the home life can, I think, readily be demonstrated in this case because there's no question that that is where my client parked her personal vehicle. She came from the home, has to come from the home, through the garage to get to the car. I think I put in my brief that obviously, a personal vehicle that you keep on your property is essential to the activities of home life. For a lot of people still, it is the means of acquiring food, medical supplies, plumbing supplies, going to work to earn the income that will keep you in the home. A personal vehicle on the personal property, I think, speaks for itself.
But isn't it a little different here, where she didn't park in the garage, there wasn't attached garage, and she parks in the driveway, which I think the thing that I keep thinking about is it's right on that public street. Anyone just driving down the public street can see it. I mean, and doesn't that attenuate that connection to the personal life of the home?
I believe the district court found that the fencing factor, the second one, was slightly attenuated. Though there is certainly no authority which holds that a driveway, simply by its proximity to the street, somehow loses its private property aspect or its personal use aspect. And that's why I cited that Velasek case in my brief. I know it's not about curtilage, but I was looking for a case. What does the law have to say about somebody in their vehicle at the end of their driveway? Well, that driver was when he was arrested for not having a license. You know, they had to throw out the conviction because even at the end of his driveway, right by the street, he was still on private property, not a public space. So that's why I cited that case. Even a driveway, the end of which abuts a public easement, like the sidewalk or the street, police need a warrant to step on there. And I want to make absolutely sure that it's clear here that in appellant's own brief, there was no question about whether the charger was extending over onto the sidewalk. The detective stepped, in appellant's words, onto the driveway to lift the tarp. I also want to make sure that the act of lifting the tarp is not inappropriately minimized here, because that is the exact same activity the police did in Collins, just in a different location on the property. It's kind of uncanny. The officer just walked onto the property and lifted the tarp on the vehicle in the carport to get its license and vehicle registration number. It's the same thing.
So, counsel for appellant makes the point that a lot of, and I think this is true, I haven't read all the cases that you probably both have read, but that a lot of these cases dealing with curtilage are set in suburban or rural settings. Which makes it a little hard to do an apples-to-apples comparison. What's a case in a more metropolitan setting you think came closest to addressing these issues of curtilage? Because kind of they're at the end of the driveway, but I think that case that you're referring to is one which was once again in rural Minnesota?
Shute was more rural.
Shute was more suburban. So help us, if you can.
This neighborhood is essentially suburban. It just is within the city of Minneapolis. I mean, you say metropolitan. So by that, I would imagine a zoning district where you're dealing with more, you know, like apartments. But this neighborhood looks like any neighborhood that I see in Richfield or Edina. The lots are the same size. The homes are about the same age. I mean, the suburban distinction here is one really without any meaning, I think, to what you're getting at. This lot that my client owns could readily have the same appearance and use and function as a lot in St. Louis Park, Edina, or Richfield. And it is the design of the lot, its function, and the placement of all the parts that are used for the activities of home life that are key here. And, I mean, you know, Collins was a residential area, though, again, it was an attached carport. Yes, I mean, and Oliver is helpful because of the open field thing. You know, it's stressed that if something is so far away from the home that it can't be involving the activities of home life, only the occasional or the ancillary, then okay. But I think from Oliver you can draw that curtilage means stuff related to the home that goes on every day. Okay, I would offer that framework. That's what the activities of home life means. That's what makes it an intimate part of your life. And in this society, you're going to use your car every day. I mean, I think most people do. There's nothing to indicate it was otherwise, which is leading me now to perhaps I just want to segue a little bit to the exigency issue. So I think the arguments put forth in appellant's reply brief just The immediately mobile thing, it was immediately mobile on November 13th, as he pointed out here today. And it was the Coolidge decision, yes, in which the Supreme Court took the officers to task for the same basic reason. You know, they knew where this vehicle was and how to find it well before they just went to the home and walked onto the property to search it. They said there, when they have this knowledge beforehand, there is simply no excuse, no exigency, no exception for them failing to obtain a warrant. The information that they had on the evening of November 13th was not just the vehicle description and the witness who saw it, but the license plate. They knew how to find it. They waited 3 weeks. I don't know why.
So, counsel, one of the statements that struck me is that we don't have information about where this... Everything you just said is correct, that the police apparently received the vehicle registration information right away, but they didn't know the location. At least we don't have that in the record, do we?
In the record, they were able to get the name and address of my client.
Right, right, but we don't have any record evidence as to the actual location of the vehicle, correct? I mean, except for the date that was searched.
I just believe there's a statement in the record that the police were able to obtain the name and address. I don't know that at 1731 Newton, if that's the address, was in the record, no. But that part the district court took from the record. That was a finding of fact. They knew the name. They knew where to find it. They simply didn't go do it. And...
Well, for all we know, they did it, and it wasn't, the vehicle wasn't there, right? That's my point, is we just don't have that information in the record.
No, but it doesn't take a veteran law enforcement officer to know what exigency means, especially given the gravity of this incident. I cannot fathom why they did not try to go to the home of this person that night. And secondly, I would question whether the police could cite, I looked at the cases cited by appellant, Gray and Welsh. So State v. Gray, murder suspect. Okay, they waited 24 hours before they made their warrantless arrest. So this, the court in that, the Gray court, struggled with that. They actually noted that the police stood outside the home for 90 minutes doing surveillance. They had to analyze whether that was too much. They decided it was a close question. But that given the nature of the situation, that he might destroy evidence or flee, that within that 24-hour period, it was still an exigency, but barely. I cannot see in any way how a curtilage or an exigency argument can be put together here. I just would...
And whose burden is it to establish those facts, counsel?
It is the burden of the state to establish whether there was an exigency present. Mm. And at the district court, it was determined that they did not. And the Maryland v. Dyson case that appellant relied on is distinguishable where the vehicle was stopped on the street. There is no curtilage, there is no property right analysis to do there. The only thing that applied was the automobile exception. So that is why Maryland v. Dyson does not apply here. I thank you for the court's attention.
And are there any other questions from the panel? Okay. Thank you, counsel. So, counsel for appellant, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. There could not have been a reasonable expectation of privacy in the license plate itself, because Minnesota law plainly requires that all motor vehicles, and it does not specify whether they need to be on private property or public property, it says all motor vehicles must display a license plate. Covering the license plate violated Minnesota statute section 169.79 subdivision 7. So there's no reasonable expectation of privacy separate from the...
And I'm not as familiar with that, but even when it's parked in someone's private driveway?
The statutory language of subdivision 7 of 169.79 does not specify where the motor vehicle is. It just says a motor vehicle must display it at all times.
Responding to a couple things that Mr. Maravigli just mentioned, Collins did have similar facts in that a law enforcement officer went onto private property, moved a tarp to look at, I believe it was either the license plate or maybe the vehicle identification number, the VIN, on the motorcycle in that case. But where Collins differs from what we have here is that that was a carport that, again, like opposing counsel mentioned, was attached to the home. It was an open carport in which one side of where the vehicle was, the open garage, you know, it was open air from the roof, was attached to the house, and the other sides had thick, I believe, brick walls on either side. And the point was made by Justice Sotomayor in that case that the fact that that particular location of the vehicle was visible from the road should not play a role in the court's analysis, because that would be punishing people who do not have the financial means to have an enclosed garage. When they park their vehicle on their property, it is still visible because they do not have a front door or a garage door to the garage. They do not have a roof. That differs from what we have here, because we literally had a garage that, for whatever reason, the car was not parked into. The photos make clear that the car would have fit inside that garage. However, it was chosen to not be there.
Well, for all we know, there is another vehicle inside the garage, right? Not uncommon in for many homeowners to have a vehicle inside the garage and outside the garage, right?
True. I don't know how many vehicles were at this garage. The record is silent.
Guess what I'm trying to get at is, I mean, we still have to think about what are the reasonable expectations of privacy. You know, whether if a homeowner has two vehicles and so one must be outside the garage, you know, is that driveway within?
And apart from the license plate, in which I don't believe there's a reasonable expectation of privacy in.
Well, I was puzzling over that comment that you made, because I don't see where the district court made any findings about the covering.
I do not believe that particular statute was provided to the district
court. No, I'm not talking about the statute. I'm saying the district court didn't make a finding that the officers, when they arrived at the scene and lifted the tarp, that the tarp was covering the license plate. Is that what you're suggesting?
I believe that is why they lifted the tarp.
Well, yes. It might be what you say, and it might be what they say. They said in their testimony, but I don't see where that impacted the district court, and that there are any fact findings about that.
There was no testimony in this case. This was a stipulated set of an aerial map and photographs that are at pages 12 through 15 of the addendum to my brief. So there was not an answer to that. My understanding, based on the limited record, is that the tarp was moved, and this is based on the district court's district court's findings of fact in the order, as well as from the complaint in this case, and that the tarp was moved to confirm that the license plate on this particular black Dodge Charger matched the license plate that had been left at the crash scene.
All right, thank you.
In my minute that I have left, Shute specifically says at page 585, this test, referring to the four Dunn factor test, this test is not a rigid one, but is designed to determine whether an individual reasonably may expect that an area immediately adjacent to the home will remain private. And if you skip ahead to when they're analyzing the third Dunn factor, which I understand the threshold question that opposing counsel mentioned, but also the third Dunn factor goes to the nature of the use to which an area is put to. And the analysis in Shute, and I understand I have 15 seconds, I will get through this as quickly as I can. In addition, the district court specifically found in Shute that the area of Shute's backyard where the camper was located was part of a turnaround or circle that is part of the driveway. An exhibit shows that in the center of that turnaround was a fire pit with a horizontal log upon which persons could sit to enjoy a fire. These activities are closely related to the home and associated with the privacies of life. I will compare that or contrast that description in Shute under the third Dunn factor with what you see on page 15 of the addendum to my brief and the driveway that we're talking about in this case. I am well past my time, and I apologize for that, Judge Bradfold. I am available to answer any further questions if the panel has any.
No, and no need to apologize. Thank you very much, counsel. This matter has been well-briefed and well-argued. We appreciate everything that the attorneys have submitted to us today. So with that, it is submitted to this court for a decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.